Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Department of Political Science and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you here this evening. The other evening, there were 15 males on the stand, and we brought out half this crowd. I hope the difference is the fact that the speaker this evening is a lady, and not because of any lack of quality the other night. It is a great pleasure to introduce to you this evening a professor, a government servant, an author, and a really and truly accomplished lady. Professor Wooten has won her spurs and a real reputation in the field of social service, in the field of law, for she is a justice of the peace, and presently chairman of the London Juvenile Court, as an economist, as a political scientist, social scientist. She is even a governor of the BBC, and anyone who can control the radio is an exceptional person. She has served as visiting professor at Barnard College. She is currently head of the Department of Social Studies, Bedford College, London University. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Barbara Wooten, who will speak on the British political scene.
Professor Dangerfield, and may I say fellow students, it gives me very great pleasure to be here on your campus, though I regret that I have only been able to see in daylight very little of it, and I am to be snatched away again already tonight. But I am glad to make this pause. I have been in this country on this occasion now for nearly 2 months, and it seems to me that my trip has solved a problem which for a long time disturbed the physicists, and that was the problem of perpetual motion. I have been, as far as I can see, in perpetual motion from this side to that side of this great continent during my stay. And I'm grateful to you here in Illinois, which is a gateway. I'm not quite sure where from or where to. Well, I'm grateful to you for letting me pass through this gateway from wherever I have come from to wherever I'm going to. It gives me a sense of pause and balance. Now, you have asked me to speak tonight about the British political scene. And may I begin by quoting a true story which happened to me at the beginning of this year. The beginning of last year. I've been here so long I've forgotten what year it is. It's a story which I think will be of interest to you because it relates to an examination. And I understand that it was expected that nobody would be here tonight owing to the pressure of examinations or the imminence of examinations. I had to set an examination for students coming into the University of London from high school. Coming straight from high school, you wouldn't expect them to know a lot about life, and one doesn't aim very high in the examination. But I thought I would like to know whether they had any understanding at all about the mutual relations of your country and my own. So I set this question. If you were writing a booklet for the visiting American coming to Great Britain for the first time, what would you put in it? And I got, as you might expect, a number of the usual answers. They would tell the visiting American that the British have no plumbing. They would tell the Americans that the British have no ice water. They would tell the Americans that all the ice that the British have, they use to put in their social manners. All what you would expect. And then I had one student who, after these platitudes and commonplaces, added something rather distinctive of his own in a little paragraph at the end. I would also tell the visiting American that in our money, a half crown is worth more than 2 shillings, and that Mr. Attlee, and not Mr. Churchill, is Prime Minister. I guarantee the verbatim truth of that story, and I need hardly assure you of the success of the student in the entrance examination. But I thought it might provide a good starting point, because it might take us back to explain something which possibly shocked and surprised a good many people in Britain, and I think undoubtedly puzzled a good many people in the United States of America. And that a study of the British political scene does need to go back at least to that election in 1945, when, for the first time, we elected a Labour government not merely to office, but to office with a commanding, not to say an almost overwhelming majority in the House of Commons. At that time, I remember Mr. Churchill conducting his election campaign. He went up and down the country with his cigar and his V sign, and he was wildly and enthusiastically cheered. And then the people who had cheered him sobered down, went home, put on their hats and coats, went to the polling booth, and voted against him. And a large part of the world turned round and said, "The fickle and ungrateful British, perfidious Albion once more." That's their idea of gratitude. Well, we saw it, I think, a little differently. Or at any rate, that half of the British people who did vote for the present government in 1945, they saw it a little differently. First of all, they gave themselves a pat on the back. We have to do that because, after all, nobody else will pat us. They gave themselves a pat on the back, saying that it was not ingratitude, but a certain political maturity. They flattered themselves that they could distinguish between Mr. Churchill as a war leader, to whom they were profoundly grateful, whose ability and courage they admired genuinely beyond all measure, and Mr. Churchill, who before the war was over had accepted office as the leader of the Conservative political party. Looking back to the scriptures, they would, I suppose, have said, in the words of St. Paul, that there is a diversity of gifts, and that what Mr. Churchill could contribute in one field, maybe somebody else could contribute better in another. And that it was, as I say, perhaps the mark of recognizing that gratitude is not an appropriate emotion in politics. It was perhaps a mark of that recognition that they did discriminate between these two characters and refrain from deifying any leader, even Mr. Churchill. You have to remember that the philosophy and attitudes associated with the British Labour Party had been growing and spreading for a long time. They date back to the early days of the British Fabian Society, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, George Bernard Shaw in his slightly less whimsical days, Graham Wallace and other names of international repute. And in the first half of this century, the sort of philosophy that these people had been thinking out had been spreading in wider and wider circles throughout the British people. It began more or less with the labor unions and the narrower working class movement. It spread more after, particularly after the First World War, it spread to a large section of the middle classes. And for a long time, a substantial group in the British community had been thinking, well, here is something that at least we would like to try. Here is something that sounds interesting, appropriate to us, that sounds civilized and democratic. So in 1945, when the war was over, perhaps not unnaturally, they believed that the war was over. They believed it was true. And they therefore set aside their wartime garments and habits of thought. And they tried experimentally what this labor movement had to offer. And I think you have to put into the picture one other thing. There is a characteristic, you know, about the government that was elected then and that was re-elected in 1950 that is rather unusual in British governments of recent times. It is, if you like, a government which is extraordinarily like ourselves. And I think that possibly was a factor in the decision. Think of its personalities. Led by Clement Attlee. Supported by many who have come up the hard way. Ernest Bevin, one-time leader of the Longshoremen's Union. His near namesake, Aneurin Bevin, who's come up from the Welsh coal mines. And I don't need to say in this country that the mines sometimes produce rather formidable personalities. A minister of education who really ought to understand education because he got most of his in night school while at work. There was that group. Then there was a group which came, if you like so to put it, from the very top drawer of English society. Frightfully, frightfully British. Hugh Dalton, brought up in circles near to the court. Our much regretted Stafford Cripps, distinguished, aristocratic, in a sense perhaps aloof, but the most devoted supporter of austerity and propagandist for austerity that I think the world has ever seen. Then there were even the academics. Hugh Gaitskill and Harold Wilson coming along behind. There was one woman, a doctor, a mother, and now Minister for National Insurance, and just one or two others, shall we say, put in to fill up. I think it gave us rather a homely feeling that there is practically no British elector from top to bottom who cannot say there in that government is somebody whose personal experience was rather like mine. That too was a factor. Well, anyway, for better or for worse, as you know, in 1945, we did put them into power. And then they got to work. Now, they had 5 busy years. And during those 5 busy years, they filled the volumes of the statute book, those red-bound volumes, so that for long they would go down to history as being of unusual size. The fact, of course, that they are red is of no particular significance. They are always bound in red, even under the bluest Conservative government. You know the kind of policy which occupied them in the first 5 years. There were 2 sides to it. There was, first of all, the nationalisation policy, transferring to public ownership some of the basic industries, in accordance with the programme they had announced before. And in accordance also, may I say, with this kind of Fabian philosophy that went back to the Webbs when they used to talk, rather in general terms perhaps, when they used to talk about production for use and not for profit. They started with nationalising coal, and then they went on to the railroads, and then they went on to the electricity industry. And then they began to talk about this trilogy of nationalised industries. Until, unfortunately, one fine morning, somebody went and looked in the Oxford English Dictionary to see what the definition of trilogy was. And it appears that it is this. A trilogy is a series of 3 tragedies to be successively performed. So then they made the trilogy into a tetralogy quickly by adding the gas industry, because that, I understand, is not a tragic form in Greek drama.